Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Before we dive into this episode, it's just a quick reminder. If you're listening to The Realignment on Apple Podcasts, please scroll to the bottom of that podcast page, rate and review us 5 stars. It bumps us up in the algorithm. It helps people find the show. We're just a couple short of 300, so if you could give us a little boost, we would just so greatly appreciate it.
So this week, we spoke with Michael Schellenberger, an environmental activist who's currently the founder and president of Environmental Progress, a research institute based out of California. His new book is Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. What makes Michael's work so interesting and why I really enjoyed this conversation is his sterling credentials in the environmental movement. His contrarian approach to the debates about the response to climate change aren't cynical or denialist. Earlier in his career, he was actually named a Time Magazine Hero of the Environment and worked with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Yeah, and what makes Michael's opposition to policy approaches such as the Green New Deal so interesting is that he couches it in rejecting the, quote, overheated, get it, rhetoric on the level of threat posed by climate change. From his belief, whenever you pull back the curtains, you actually find that these approaches are doomed to failure and that there are a lot more alternative approaches like nuclear energy that need to be looked at. On top of all of his environmental work, Michael previously ran for governor of California during the 2018 Democratic primary. He's got a lot of heterodox views on the issues that are facing the state. We really enjoy talking with him about the challenges that are facing California because of so many of the themes that we focus on during the show that are so clearly at play in that state. So with all of that, let's dive in.
Michael Schellenberger, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So I think the first most obvious question is, what's it like to write and release a book called Apocalypse Never during COVID-19?
Oh, man. Yeah, well, it gives you some perspective, right? Everybody said climate crisis would shut down civilization. Turned out a pandemic did that. So, I mean, the obvious thing is just that clearly, you know, here we are in the midst of a pandemic that's killed 500,000 people. It really is a threat to civilization. You know, I mean, not in the sense of ending it, but, you know, we have the economies in deep trouble and it's exposed all these divides in the society. And it just shows, you know, what a real crisis looks like as opposed to climate change, which is a problem. It's real. It's something we should deal with, but it's not something that requires actions within days or weeks. It requires a long-term vision, you know, turning over the energy infrastructure of the country, but it's not something we should panic about.
So that's interesting, Michael, because you immediately go towards that. And I think that's one of the things that we want to tease out with you, which is that with the book, which is that in amongst heterodox people who want to talk about climate change, one of the most difficult things and problems that they face is that you can simultaneously believe that climate change is real, but you can also not believe some of the most alarmist rhetoric that is coming out. And if you go against the rhetoric, then you're painted as a climate change denier. So climate change is real, but let's break down what is the current state of climate science itself, and also just offer the audience just a little bit of a, you know, like what makes you qualified to write about this? Why? How did you look into it? What's your background whenever it comes to this state of affairs?
Sure. So I've been an environmentalist since I was 16, which is an astonishing 33 years ago. Mostly concerned about deforestation in the Amazon, but I became very concerned about climate change with others in the late 80s. Particularly what happened is that as the threat of nuclear war declined when the Soviet Union fell apart, people who wanted to have an apocalyptic fear, and we can talk about why I'm using the word wanted, but the people who wanted to have that apocalyptic fear had shifted to climate change. It's very clear that that transition occurred. Also, fears of overpopulation had been declining for about a decade by then. So I've been involved in climate, you know, advocacy directly for at least 20 years. I've been writing on it for that long. I was invited by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to be an expert reviewer of their next assessment report. I was invited by Congress to testify, which I did in January. I've given testimony to the Japanese government, South Korean governments, Dutch governments, all around the world for over a decade. I've organized a coalition of climate scientists to help keep nuclear plants running, because whenever they're shut down, they're replaced by fossil fuels. So I am a climate activist. I consider myself an energy and climate expert. And I guess that's my qualifications. I'm also the father of a 14-year-old. And while she's fine, because I explained the science to her, her friends are very scared and they have no idea. They think plastic straws are causing climate change. They think that they worry that they may not be able to live a full life or be able to have kids because of climate change. And that's just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong to terrify children. Mm-hmm. It's wrong to, you know, I mean, if, you know, it's, if it were really what people were saying, it would be, of course, you know, we should tell kids that they need to wear a mask to protect themselves from the pandemic, but it's wrong to tell kids that the world is coming to an end because of climate change. And I felt motivated to speak out because the alarmism has actually causing psychological problems and it's fueling a kind of politics, which is just completely toxic to the culture and toxic to actually doing the things that we need to do to protect the environment.
Yeah.
So what then is climate change, right? So what is the threat that we sort of face, right? Sort of in your initial sort of tying of this to COVID-19, you said this isn't a civilizational threat, but this is a threat that needs to be confronted in the long term. How would you define the threat?
Well, it's really challenging. And the, of course, the IPCC and other climate scientists struggle with describing it because what you're describing is, you know, human changes to global temperatures over time. And then the effects of those temperature changes are really different in different parts of the world. They're much more dramatic in the poles than in the equator. They also, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties. So for example, if you double the amount of carbon dioxide from pre-industrial times to from 280 parts per million to 560, the temperature increase could be between, according to IPCC, 2 degrees and 4.5 degrees. Well, that's a huge difference. In fact, mm-hmm. there's been some debate about whether they should even widen what is called the climate sensitivity to 1.5 degrees to 4.5 degrees. So you have a huge amount of uncertainty. There's going to be a lot less change at 1.5 than at 4.5. And change in natural environments is problematic, so to speak, because it might mean that species are, you know, lose their habitats. It might mean that agriculture could shift. Now, the good news is that humans are incredibly adaptive species. That's why I don't think this is catastrophic for human civilizations. We're able to farm all over the world. We're able to adapt our farming to different temperatures. And really what determines how much food we grow is whether we're using fertilizer, irrigation, tractors, just the basic mechanics of modern agriculture, more than modest changes in temperature over time. But all things being equal, you'd rather tend towards the side of less temperature change because, you know, humans have a huge presence on the earth, a massive impact. The biggest impact is through food production. Humans use about half of the ice-free surface of the earth. The biggest share of that half, almost half of that half, is just meat production, mostly pasture. So, but there's even good news here. I mean, there's a lot of good news. So the first piece of good news is that the amount of the earth that we use for meat production has been going down for 20 years. In fact, we've said that we've reduced the area that we use for meat production almost the same size area as Alaska. Carbon emissions have peaked in most rich countries. They've actually peaked and been going down in Britain, France, and Germany since the mid-70s. They've been going down in the United States for almost 15 years. That's been occurring mostly by the transition from coal to natural gas. And everybody, almost everybody thinks that natural gas is better than coal in terms of just the smoke, the air pollution, about half as much carbon emissions. And then the final piece of good news is just that we're becoming much more resilient to natural disasters. I mean, this is maybe the most underpublicized fact in my book is that there's been a decline in deaths from natural disasters by 90% over the last 100 years. The decline has been 80%. Wow. Over the last 40 years. This means that there's millions of fewer people every year being washed away by hurricanes or killed or starved or suffering diseases or malnutrition associated with natural disasters. And those of us in the rich world, we just don't really have any sense of what that's like. But in my book, I interview one of the characters is a young Indonesian woman who moved from the country to the city. And I asked her about life in the country. And like all of the bad events were natural disasters, including the volcano, you know? And so you realize that really the big story here is just that humans we're developing. There's a lot of us. We're obviously the most successful species in terms of controlling our environments. And that's just had some sad and negative impacts on other species and habitats. That's the main event. I mean, if you care about the natural environment, that's the big event. And climate change, you know, I wouldn't really put as a top environmental issue, both because we have so many more direct impacts, and second, because so many of the key metrics on climate change have been going in the right direction, not the wrong direction.
Well, what I really love about how you're talking is there's a case for optimism there, is that I don't feel, as you say, as a 14-year-old, I can't imagine being 14 years old and being told that the world is going to end. And, you know, I read these pieces about people who are afraid of reproducing because they believe they're truly going to be, you know, bringing a child into such an uncertain and terrible world that will end very quickly. What is the problem with apocalyptic language and framing of climate change whenever it comes to actually doing anything about it?
Right. Well, it's interesting because in some ways, my Apocalypse Never is the bookend to 15 years of writing on this topic. The essay I became most famous for was called The Death of Environmentalism. And in it, we pointed to all this evidence showing that the alarmist discourse is actually depressing and discouraging for most people. Now, when you become an activist and you start spreading alarmism, you do get a kind of high from it. You do feel a kind of titillation and some recognition that you are woke and you're spreading, you know, the gospel of the end of the world, but really it's mostly the effect is depressing. In fact, I noticed this with myself because I love reading histories of the civil rights movement, and I was reading a lot of Parting the Waters, which is one of the most beautiful histories ever written by Taylor Branch about the civil rights movement. And I would read the books about the civil rights movement, and afterwards I would feel happy. Like literally I would feel happier after reading these, because it was stories of using love to fight hate. It's just the most profound, one of the most profound human experiences. And then I would read environmental books and I would be depressed. And I was very struck by my different emotional reactions to it. And and that started me down the journey. It was actually, I got more in touch with my with the psychological reactions, the negative psychological reactions to apocalyptic environmentalism before I really understood the technical side, you know, the energy technologies, energy transitions, or much of the history. I learned all that later, but the initial thing that got me going on this was just how crappy apocalyptic environmentalism made me feel.
So let's dive into that though then, because that's interesting because, you know, obviously Parting the Waters is basically, it's the tome, right? It's the series you would read to understand the civil rights movement. But isn't it one thing to read a history 40, 50 years later than actually to experience it? Because I think experiencing the Jim Crow South during the 1950s, I doubt that would be a particularly uplifting experience, right? Like I think, you know, think of 1968 when, you know, MLK and RFK are killed in the same time, you know, and then you have the riots in the city. So I think if I were to push back from a devil's advocate perspective, I'd say that it probably would feel depressing at the end of the day, right? And if climate change is dealt with properly, you could have a history that feels good in 2100. But while it's going on, when has change, social or otherwise, ever been a good experience that made people happy?
Oh, well, first of all, you're making an excellent point, which is that I hear you saying when you're in the midst of doing important work often, it's actually quite painful. And that's very true. So yes. And often we don't really appreciate it until afterwards. Now, of course, I think people that had the experience of being at the March on Washington and hearing the I Have a Dream speech, I bet they did leave that experience feeling quite happy and uplifted. And they knew that King was going to go meet with Kennedy at the White House right afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly getting beat up by hateful racists in the South had to be horrible. You know, at the same time, I think that there's so much in that. I adore that book. You know, I had a part of the book I actually left out. I got obsessed with Rosa Parks because Extinction Rebellion, who I criticize in the book, the crazy climate activists in Britain, they cited Rosa Parks at one point, and I was so offended because they basically almost started a riot on the London Tube, the London Underground.
They were disrupting, weren't they disrupting travel and making it hard, like impossible for people to get to work? That was their strategy? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was like, my response to it was like, you're doing the opposite of Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks was trying to get working people access to public transportation. You're trying to prevent working people from being transported publicly.
When you say it that way.
And the motivations are different. I mean, Rosa Parks is this, on the one hand, she's sort of a radical and she's sort of part of Highlander Institute. And, she's actually a more serious person than the fairy tale version of her is often suggested. At the same time, it wasn't like I'm going to prevent the world from coming to an end. It was I'm going to deliver equality for my people.
Right.
It was so beautiful. And I became obsessed with Rosa Parks. And for whatever reason, I stumbled across this incredible story, which you guys probably know about, but I'd never heard, where Martin Luther King is giving a speech on stage at some event, and like a crazy guy jumps on stage and starts hitting him in the face and beating on him. And King, truly being a true pacifist, which are deeply rare things in this world, very rare. King takes it. Now somebody finally pulls the guy off him, but the people in the crowd, it was like almost like a spiritual experience. I mean, it was like watching somebody sacrificing himself in just the most perfect way. I couldn't do it, and I'm not recommending it, but it was it struck me as such a contrast to the Extinction Rebellion protesters on top of the tube, one of the working class passengers trying to pull the guy off the tube, and the Extinction Rebellion protester starts kicking the guy in the face.
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine something that's like two opposite reactions.
Any listeners should look this up because this video went really viral.
Yeah, I remember this.
So yeah, this was a whole thing.
So one thing I want to get into you with, Michael, is that the left, the progressive left, appears to kind of internalize some of what you said, as in that, it's depressing, the apocalyptic rhetoric. So what they have done is that they've bolstered their apocalyptic message with a forward-thinking plan. They call this the Green New Deal, which has become trendy. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is releasing these posters, which are like what cities will look like, in the mold of a New Deal poster.
Very cool.
From the 1940s. Yeah, they look really cool, very retro. I'd probably put one on my wall. So this seems to be a way that they've squared that circle of having, apocalyptic nature, but also a sense of optimism. Now, what's the issue, though, if we're going to look at their optimistic framework, which is the Green New Deal? How do you look at it?
Well, first of all, I love the posters, too.
Yeah.
We're seeing the problem
here. I know. See, they're awesome. They're awesome posters.
Well, I love the posters. My wife decorated my office because she has a great eye, and she bought these World Fair posters from 1933 in the depths of the Depression, and they're the most inspiring posters you'll ever see. Those World Fair posters, those New Deal posters, these are stories of optimism. Rosie the Riveter, right? And the Civil Rights Movement, right? Very inspiring, very aspirational. They're grounded in very mainstream values of equal opportunity, freedom, universal prosperity. We're all in this together. So yes, 100% yes. Now, there's a problem for the Green New Deal, which is that future is not possible with renewables. Hmm. That future is possible with nuclear, not possible with renewables, because their low power densities inevitably mean they can't power a high energy industrial civilization. And this has been well established. There's these amazing scholarly research into the Industrial Revolution required coal. Could not have happened on wood for basic physical reasons. It just did not produce enough heat energy. So that's the problem with the Green New Deal. Now, they know they have a problem. I some of my most read columns for Forbes last year were me criticizing the Green New Deal for being anti-nuclear. And I can't say who, but I yesterday I had a very long, interesting conversation with a very senior Democratic Party, you know, lion in winter, let's say, former very famous person who wanted to talk. They had been reading my book, says he's pro-nuclear and, you know, are trying to kind of make it part of the Green New Deal. But it's a huge, huge problem for the Democrats, this issue. And, you know, I've been campaigning for nuclear for the last 5 years. We've saved a lot of nuclear plants around the world. Indiana, New York, Illinois, Connecticut, New Jersey. You know, we have a big campaign in Britain. I just hired a former Extinction Rebellion spokesperson. In fact, I hired my book, I don't want to spoil it, but at the end, one of the Extinction Rebellion protesters who I've been interviewing confesses to me that she's pro-nuclear. So it makes it into the end of the book. As I decided that Britain was such an important country for nuclear a couple of weeks ago, I called her up out of the blue and was like, will you help me on this campaign? And she said, yes. So we made headlines in Britain. So I do think it's been a trickle, but I do think a flood is coming of people who can no longer sustain the contradiction between their apocalyptic climate change discourse and their aversion to nuclear.
Yeah. So a question on, Sagar and I are in our late 20s. We sort of came to political consciousness during the Al Gore Inconvenient Truth documentary space, right? So after 2006, I think what I always remember is back when I was in high school, I would sort of hear those 350.org, if we don't act within 5 years, insert apocalyptic sort of outcome. It's been, you know, 13 years since then, right? So I guess what I don't understand, I think a lot of our listeners would help trying to understand, because we're really trying to speak to people who are skeptical of the Green New Deal, but also don't deny climate change. Why do the timelines keep shifting? I feel like the timelines on when renewable energy are going to be viable keep shifting. I feel like the sort of end date keeps shifting. Is this a messaging problem? Is this a scientific issue? There's a lot there, but I think that's just, I always just think back to listening to those ads back in high school when people still listened to the radio. Yeah. That was a thing.
Great question. Well, let me say just briefly how I think about climate change and our response to it, because I think it just to sort of say it as short a version as possible, which is that the big picture is 7.5 billion people, probably going to be at least 9 or 10 before population peaks and declines. A lot of people, they all want and are going to fight to live high energy lives like ours. So going back to a low energy economy is not an option. We have to provide high energy to people. Even people who say they are going to live a low energy life, live a high energy life. So we need a lot of energy. So the option is not energy or not energy. It's how to get a lot of energy. The planet, it better to err on the side of lower temperature increase than higher, because you get much worse impacts at higher temperatures. Yes, there's a lot of uncertainty. Like I said, you know, a doubling of CO2 can get you between 1.5 degrees warming or 4.5 degrees. Figuring that out in any more detail doesn't matter to what you do. All that matters, and this is true for both prosperity and climate protection, is moving people up the energy ladder. And by that, I mean from wood and dung to coal and hydroelectricity to petroleum, natural gas, and eventually to uranium. For reasons I explain in the book, I think solar and wind are a very small part of that and are mostly destructive to the environment because of the low power densities of solar and wind. But if you're concerned
about the birds, that's the most important question for the birds.
Yeah, and the birds. But just to finish the thumbnail on the climate, it just what matters is moving towards cleaner sources of energy. So this is why I dedicate most of my time to keeping nuclear plants online. Mm-hmm. And building new nuclear plants. I do think there are some problems that come from climate change. It's a real issue, and nuclear is important for a lot of other issues that don't have anything to do with climate change. But nonetheless, the goal is to keep the world cooler rather than warmer, all things being equal. That means moving from coal to natural gas to nuclear. Going from natural gas to nuclear is good. Going from nuclear to natural gas is bad. Going from coal to natural gas is good. Going from natural gas to coal is bad. Same thing, going from coal to wood is bad. You know, going back down the energy ladder is bad. That's it. I want to think, I would like for people to think of this in this, I think you should think about it in the simplest way possible. And the simplest way possible is it's good to go up the energy ladder for people in the environment. It's bad to go down it. And that includes for climate change.
Got it. I think that's actually a very useful framework. So premised in your assumption, premised in your drive to nuclear, which we're going to get into right after this, is the idea that majority of the people on Earth are going to need more energy in order to consume and live bountiful lives, these 9 to 10 billion. So the prospect of this project, any project, in order to keep the Earth cooler, is to produce more energy and up the energy ladder in a more cleaner fashion. Now, what did you think then, though, of Michael Moore just produced a new documentary, which has become very popular, which actually doesn't really say it kind of says the opposite. It basically says there's only one way to save the climate. Renewables are a pipe dream, largely funded by, you know, funded by special interests. And that the truth is that the only way we can do anything about this is to cut consumption.
And a quick bookend to that, too, is that I think people look at I think we all saw that beautiful photo of Los Angeles after a month of lockdown during COVID where, you know, we saw and the same is true of Venice and the canals and everything. So, yeah, just response to that argument.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the book, in the research for the book, this question that was driving me crazy was, why are the people who are most alarmist about climate change most opposed to the solutions? Why is it the people that say the world is ending from climate change, why are they opposed to nuclear natural gas? And what you discover is that there's actually a tradition that has nothing to do with the environment, which is started by a British economist named Thomas Malthus in the late 1800s.
Yep.
And the argument was just that humans are doomed to famine because we will always have more kids than we'll grow food. Well, it was immediately disproven. In fact, it was never true. If it were true, there wouldn't be 7.5 billion of us. But it wasn't true then either because there were so many more people on Earth. And in fact, people pointed out, they said, well, why don't people just use condoms and birth control and have fewer kids? And what Malthus said is he said, because that would be immoral for reasons that had nothing, he claimed it was against God's will. I'll let the theologians debate that. But nonetheless, he said that can't happen because it would be immoral. Fast forward to the 60s, same story. We're going to have famines, people warned, because there's too many people. And the response was, well, no, that we're not, because we'll just use fertilizer, tractors, and irrigation to produce more food. And what do they say? They said, no, that would be immoral to impose all of this horrible modernity and prosperity on poor people. That was the idea. Now you get to climate change, and we're in a very similar thing. The only way we can deal with climate change is if we all get a lot poorer, and poor people will let them get a little bit richer. They can have a solar panel and a battery for their hut, but they don't get to move to the city and live high energy, prosperous, modern lives. I think that's highly unethical, and obviously even environmentalists are some of the richest people in the world, and they are the highest energy consuming people in the world. So you get to the filmmakers of that movie, and the part of the movie I thought was really great was they document how destructive renewable energy projects are. Mm-hmm. But solar farms and wind farms are equally destructive in communist societies as they are in capitalist ones. And yet the movie suggested that the reason for the destructiveness was capitalism. Well, it doesn't have anything to do with capitalism. It's a physical, energy is a physical process of transforming energy flows like sunlight and wind into electricity, or transforming energy stocks like coal, oil, uranium into heat and then into electricity. It's a physical process. It doesn't have to do with like socialism or capitalism. And so what's driving the filmmakers of Planet of the Humans is Malthusianism. It's reactionary. It's been debunked for as long as it's existed, for the full 200 years. It's actually a right-wing political philosophy, not a left-wing one.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, what makes it right? And to be clear, I mean, I interviewed these guys, the Planet of the Humans guys. I even asked them straight up. I was like, sounds to me like you're advocating population control. They're like, well, we never said the words population control once. And I was like, well, but, you know.
So the thing we mostly do on this podcast is we're really interested in ideology and how these ideologies are shifting. What is right wing about their framing?
Well, let me say conservative. Let me say Malthusian is, yeah. So Malthus is a conservative view. It's conservative, I think, in the fatalism. And I don't mean that as a put down, by the way. I actually think there's a kind of philosophical fatalism that I embrace that I think is actually healthy, which is part of the Serenity Prayer. And there's a kind of, I think there's some fatalism in the conservative reaction to COVID that I understand, you know. So for example, everybody talks about all these heat wave deaths that Paris had in 2003. And everybody blames it on climate change. And you can blame some of it on climate change. You can also blame it on the fact that they didn't protect the elderly by getting them in air conditioned places. And you can also blame it on the fact that they had a mild flu season. And so fewer elderly people died the previous winter and thus died in the summer heat wave. And so the fatalism is a little bit like, hey, are we going to completely destroy the economy just to keep a few people from dying a couple weeks earlier, a couple months earlier? So there's nothing wrong with fatalism necessarily. Mm-hmm. There is something very wrong with the Malthusian fatalism, but it is a conservative political movement. If you define and its contrast at the time was Godwin in Britain and Condorcet in France, or two big Enlightenment thinkers who wrote books basically saying we can use human reason, knowledge, and technology basically to make humans immortal. I mean, like most progressives, they overstated the case a bit. you know. I mean, I like the pure case in some ways, because you have these two pure, in some ways they are extremes. You know, you have Godwin saying technology is going to make us immortal, and you have Malthus saying we're doomed to recurring famines.
Right.
So that is how it is up until the 1960s. Marx and Engels in, I guess it's mid-19th century, I don't know the exact year, it was 1848. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, my Marxism is a little old now, a little 48 rusty. 48
sounds right.
They basically said Malthus is a stain on the human race. I mean, really, they couldn't, he represented everything they hated. They were in the tradition of the Enlightenment in the sense that, you know, Marx and Engels thought that we should use technology to improve human life. They differed, of course, with many liberals and others who felt that, you know, that sort of this division between this competitive, unequal survival of the fittest economy alongside a political democracy of equality and equal citizenry. They disagreed on that part, but they nonetheless had a lot of faith in technology and in fact pioneered this idea that technological revolutions were the driving force of economic growth, which Schumpeter would pick up later. But so that was the left-right split until you get to the 60s. And so I was obsessed with this question of like, why is it that a right-wing philosophy is embraced by the new left? I mean, it's mm-hmm. the new left in my book, in my research, I discovered, you know, it's the after World War II, the greatest generation liberals, many of them had served in the war, some of them had served on the Manhattan Project to invent the bomb. They were optimistic. They were, and they were not like, you know, namby-pamby. That's how they got portrayed. They were not sort of gentlemanly. They were activists in terms of protecting the environment. They fought to save the redwoods. They fought to save many parts of California. But they were pro-nuclear, and they were pro-nuclear because they knew that they had to have a high-energy civilization. In fact, they actually explicitly described this in the mid-60s. They said, if we're not going to wreck California's environment, we have to have nuclear power. The new left, who used Malthus, overthrew the good guys, in my view, the humanistic conservationists, the greatest generation conservationists, And they did so with a very reactionary right wing, and I think quite colonialist ideology, which they called lifeboat ethics. Which, if you ask me, it's not an ethics at all. The idea that you should create a whole philosophy around justifying keeping people out of the lifeboat is a pretty amazing thing. But that's a Malthusian turn. And what we call environmentalism, what I call apocalyptic environmentalism in my book, to distinguish it from pro-nuclear environmentalism, is anti-human, it's anti-progress, it's pro-poverty, it's pro a return to agrarian economy, or at least keeping people in the agrarian economy, and as some idea of sustainability with nature.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's really well said. It's such a fascinating kind of philosophical turn, which intuitively it does make sense. You can see that transition from the conservation to kind of the fatalism and then the embrace of quasi-Malthusianism, which is really is horseshoe theory at its best, right? Everything far left becomes far right. So let's talk about nuclear then. So the nuclear is the missing key in the is a missing piece of the puzzle for the Green New Deal, for new environmentalism, for optimism. What is driving the movement against nuclear power, in your view? And what is the affirmative case to be made for it with a public which is, we have to be honest, is terrified after Chernobyl and Fukushima?
Well, this is...
And by that, we mean the HBO miniseries.
Yeah, very the HBO.
Right, right. Yeah, so this is a very interesting question, right? So you look at the basic physics of energy sources, of the amount of land they use, the amount of materials they use. Nuclear wins on every criteria, hands down. And it's for the same reason. It's energy dense. It's not exactly that uranium is more energy dense than coal. It's just that the energy that is released when you split the atom is so much greater than the energy that's released when you split the molecules, and so through combustion. So nuclear fission is this radical event in human history, and it will be viewed as a radical event thousands of years from now. It just so happens that it happened 75 years ago, which is just like yesterday in terms of, you know, there's living people that remember it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's this radical event. It comes right out of science. It was going to happen whether or not there was World War II. And as soon as it happens, and they had known already for 50 years that it would result both in high density electricity and in a bomb. Like, they knew that it would have these two functions because that's what energy is. So this radical event occurs. And then two things are going on, and they're related. But one of them is that it freaks people out. I mean, it is genuinely terrifying. It still is terrifying. It should be terrifying. That's how nuclear weapons work. Mm-hmm. Nuclear weapons work by scaring the living daylights out of the leaders of India and Pakistan, so much so that when their own countrymen want to go to war with each other because they hate each other so much, it's the leaders of the countries who are like, yeah, we're going to let some of you guys kill each other, and then there's just no way in hell this is going to escalate. Right. That's the power of nuclear weapons. And as soon as it's developed, in fact, before even it's tested, the best thinkers knew that the effect of nuclear weapons would be to end war, effectively. They knew that it would basically allow a leveling of the playing fields between small countries and big countries, that even ridiculous and dinky countries like North Korea could secure its borders from the most powerful nation that's ever existed, which is the United States. There's no risk that the United States is going to proactively attack North Korea now, because we're not willing to sacrifice San Francisco. Thank heavens, I live here. So the bomb is this radical event. Now, there's some people that a lot of people are like, this is terrible. There's some people that are like, wow, it could be good. It is notable that the people who thought it'd be terrible were people who thought they were going to achieve world peace in a different way. Mostly
arms control agreements, international arrangements, that sort of
League of Nations.
Yeah. Wilsonian World War I stuff.
Right. You got it. Exactly. A lot of pacifists, a fair number of socialists. George Orwell was upset because he said, oh, well, now the little people can't overthrow the government because the big governments will have the bomb. which is ridiculous, like in multiple ways, but there was sort of a, and then, you know, the, there was anti-nuclear weapons advocacy funded by the Soviet Union, though I don't think it was, I don't even mention it in the book. It's not that important. But there was this big fear of the bomb, some of which is understandable, some of which was manipulated. Then you had the Malthusianism that I described. Malthusians, of course, are threatened by nuclear, because if you have nuclear energy, then you have no justification to either raise the alarm about resource scarcity or demand control over the economy to limit resource consumption, because nuclear means infinite energy, and infinite energy means infinite fertilizer, and it means infinite fresh water, and therefore it means infinite food, so that we'll never run out of food for technical reasons, which of course really wasn't happening very much anyway. Usually when there's famines, it's a consequence of war or some kind of political action. It's not because, oh my God, we forgot how to grow food. So Malthusians team up with the anti-nuclear weapons folks, and they basically use the bomb to terrify people about nuclear power plants in ways that are muddled deliberately and made confusing. You know, in the book, I talk about how I saw a friend of mine who I was doing left-wing activism with in the late 90s, who came to me and he said, okay, you've convinced me. I agree we need nuclear. How can I help? And we talked a bit. I told him what I tell everybody, which is that the most important thing is for you to come out of the closet as pro-nuclear. That's the main event, I believe, for saving nuclear. I don't think there's a technical fix. And then I said, he was part of the anti-nuclear weapons movement because he's about 10 years older than I am, so late 70s. And he said, yeah, you know, he's like, it's funny because I remember when we switched from campaigning against weapons to campaigning against power plants. And I was like, well, what were you thinking? I mean, did you think that if you got rid of the nuclear power plants and somehow we were going to ban the bomb? And he kind of paused and looked out into the distance. I could see him thinking. And he goes, you know, we just didn't really talk or think much about it. You know, so it's almost a kind of miasma, or I don't know what the right word is, a kind of vapor or something, an aura. And I would find it in the literature, stuff that didn't even make the book, there's so much of it, but people would, well, it's even in my life, but I would, people would describe nuclear power plants as kind of evil. You know, there, you kind of go, well, because, and I think it's harder for millennials, you know, or Zoomers to understand, because even me as a Gen Xer, you know, I mean, you're now, I mean, every, I always joke, every generation finds a way to traumatize its children about nuclear, you know, and I was like, maybe the exception will be the millennials. And then HBO announced the Chernobyl TV series,
right?
You know, and I was like, okay, so everybody's going to, but it, like, you know, cause like in the '50s, I mean, I look back and you go, it was like insane. Like the government like made TV movies depicting nuclear holocaust and showed them to children. Like, I don't know why, like, how did that even make sense? And I just think they were just, everybody was really freaked out. So, but then that sort of, I get to be in the late 80s and it's The Day After, which is this TV miniseries about nuclear holocaust.
It's a great series. It's
yeah, it really is good.
That's sort of the problem here. The television's consistent.
Yeah, because of course adversity makes for heroism. And this is sort of getting at another theme in the book, which is the desire to be heroic, particularly for people who don't believe in God anymore. So, you know, the bomb, you know, creating a world without nuclear became the heroic project of baby boomers, you know, mostly, of course, the left. But really, I mean, generationally, it was so powerful, ridding the world of nuclear. And what that meant was turning away from all this horror, which all got kind of wrapped in together. You know, you read this, they always say, you know, it was, you know, it's we're moving away from all the evils of the death camps at Auschwitz and nuclear weapons. And you're kind of like, well, what, I mean, like, first of all, one of those things actually ended World War II. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like the bomb started World War II or that the bomb was used to exterminate people. It ended a war. Now, you could argue that there were ways to end the war while saving more lives. I personally think it's nonsense. I did look into this, by the way. I think many more people would have died had we had a land invasion. Right. The estimates were somewhere around 1 million people. But nonetheless, this discourse, so what you got was the construction of a devil, basically. So you get a new religion and you get this perfect new devil. It's uranium, it's nuclear. You get this perfect Faust story of the mad scientist. You've got this perfect apocalyptic ending. And so then naturally you're going to have a book of Genesis and you're going to have a story about nature. And this is going to work really well for people who no longer believe in Judeo-Christianity. It's going to work really well for people who, you know, are socially insecure, existentially insecure. They need something to believe in. And most of all, they need a story of themselves as heroes. And that's what occurred. And so people felt like stopping nuclear power plants was a heroic act, that they were protecting not just their own communities, but the whole world from nuclear Armageddon.
What's interesting is this is all a lot of, these are very end of history 1990s problems.
Yeah, they really are.
So in our last section, you know, this podcast is called The Realignment, obviously, and we'd be remiss of not talking about California, where you've previously ran for office. And you've been very vocal about not just sort of the case for nuclear in the state, but how sort of things are going on. And I think Sagar and I, when we were talking about this episode before, we think California is so important because if we look at a lot of trends that are happening in our politics, the hyperpolarization, the sort of working with an increasingly diverse state, sort of a higher education system that in many ways in the 60s was sort of the crown jewel of the world, but right now is overexpensive, housing, homelessness, you know, fights with big tech, AB5, there's so much there. So I'm just sort of curious if you have any sort of broad thesis about the state. And because I think what's so interesting about what I've actually really appreciated about this conversation is that, as I understand it, you're a Democrat, but I think a lot of the things you were saying are heterodox in a compelling way. But if you look at a state like California, like it's a one-party state, so there's no real sort of way for expressing thoughts that that go against the establishment. I'm just curious, do you have any general thoughts on that sort of rant I just gave? Because I think it's very important for people to think
about. Not a rant at all. You spoke a lot of truth there. Mm-hmm. California is an incredibly important state. In some ways, I think it's the most American state. It's a state obsessed with freedom, with individual freedom. But it needs to be balanced by responsibility. And by responsibility, I mean both individual and social responsibility. So yes, I do think that is a bit heterodoxical, though it shouldn't be. I don't think there's a single conservative who thinks there shouldn't be social responsibility. And I don't think there's a single liberal who thinks there shouldn't be individual responsibility. We have a Statue of Liberty on the East Coast. We need a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. There's not a single psychiatrist in America who thinks that the best way to treat people with schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder is with a combination of heroin, fentanyl, and methamphetamine. And yet that's how we treat our mentally ill here. It's a complete disgrace. It's a moral abomination. It's an embarrassment that we have 125,000 homeless people. Only 25% of them are housed. We are so pretentious and so patronizing in our anti-racism, and yet we are, and yet the people that are suffering the worst overwhelmingly are African Americans. This is a state that pioneered humanistic psychology, that was the home of the anti-psychiatry movement, and yet we are leaving our most severely mentally ill people literally on the streets. To sleep and eat and defecate, where we let them shoot up themselves with the worst drugs in the world, the worst drugs, and they keep getting worse. And we had one fentanyl overdose a day last year, almost in San Francisco. So this is absolutely outrageous. It's really the active destruction of civilization, which means cities, which means, you know. Here, how many conferences have been held in San Francisco on livable cities, on healthy cities, and yet it's not safe to walk down many streets? Look, with the community, it's really quite reprehensible. Basically, the rich neighborhoods in San Francisco have decided to contain. They had decided to contain all of the word homeless doesn't really describe it. The severely mentally ill, the severely drug addicted. People living in tents, they'd concentrated them in working class neighborhoods of color while moralizing about racism and the Republican Party. Anyway, as you can tell, I'm so upset and outrageous outraged.
No, that's good.
That's a good thing. Yeah, you're speaking a lot of truth here.
Yeah, I've decided that my next book is going to be about San Francisco, and it's really answering this question that's just been driving me nuts, which is how did a city so committed to progressive values when it comes to race, when it comes to class, when it comes to mental illness, when it comes to compassion, how did a city like San Francisco end up creating what is basically an open air drug market for severely mentally ill people to be using the worst drugs in the world and really destroying communities and the livability of what I think is the greatest city in America?
Yeah. So my last question, it's an idea that I think I want this podcast to focus more on moving forward, is that how do we do two things? One, and this relates back to our climate change conversation, how do we de-escalate culture war issues, drugs, homelessness, climate change? Because I think the second that you talk about climate change, I think there are a lot of people on the right, some who may listen to this podcast, are going to sort of tune out the conversation because they're going to think of climate change not from a scientific perspective, but from this perspective of, I don't like AOC. There's cow farting stuff that's really silly. I'm not going to engage with that.
It's very emotional.
And then on and then sort of to the whole issue of San Francisco and California, because my sort of thesis on this is that the issue is that our politics have become overly nationalized. So if you're right, so for example, if you're running for office, you know, as an alternative to the Democratic establishment in California, as a Republican, right, sort of two-party system, you're going to have to answer for what's happening in D.C. or what's happening of Trump or what's happening of culture war issues. So you're not going to have a situation, because I'm from Oregon, so I think a lot of the political dynamics are similar. How do you think, sort of closing thoughts, and how can we de-escalate these culture war issues, and how can we sort of denationalize our political issues so that if you're trying to fix, you know, San Francisco, from a heterodox perspective, you don't have to answer for whatever things are happening in DC. And if you're trying to sort of address climate change to the right, you don't have to answer to sort of broader culture war issues that obviously aren't going to be solved by any piece of legislation. There's a lot there, so I'm not expecting the perfect thesis, but I'm curious.
No, it's terrific. Terrific question, by the way. And you guys have asked the really excellent questions. Very thoughtful questions. This is an important question that you're asking, a question about defusing the culture wars, about kind of depolarizing, about kind of talking back to the extremes. I think this is the most important question in many ways. I've been doing this long enough now that, and I did Apocalypse Never, not as a polemic or as a manifesto. I've written a polemic and a manifesto. I actually think there's a really, important role for polemics and manifestos. I really do. I think they're very important genres. I knew that that wouldn't be enough anymore, that I had to get the facts together. So there's a lot of stuff. We have a lot of people say the facts don't matter, or people say facts don't care about your feelings. And that's all true. I think so, but I kind of go, you got to have the facts. You have to contest the facts. You know, we just uploaded a bunch of facts on our website about these issues. I interviewed my daughter's friends over Zoom who are very alarmist. And I asked them what they would find helpful. And they were like, we need someone to just present some facts, you know, cause they don't know. Someone they look up to, Greta Thunberg or AOC. And let's be clear. They look up to them in ways that they'll never look up to me. You know, boring old dad. And then AOC and Greta Thunberg said the world's going to end in 10 years. That's hard for them to process. Well, why would they lie to me about that? You know, so you got to give them the facts. Then you have to answer that question. Well, why would they not be telling you the truth about this? Well, that's a really important question. And actually, I think 14-year-old girls are old enough to talk to about that. Why would some people kind of misrepresent reality sometimes? You know, either deliberately or not on purpose, either deliberately lying or not on purpose. And I think that helps. My book tries to do three things: debunk the bad misinformation and myths, explain how people save natural environment in the real world. And then the third section is on what is going on. Why are these people so misleading and so alarmist and so apocalyptic? What's driving it? So I think those three things are all important. I'm intending for my San Francisco book, which I hope to come out next year, I'm working on already, basically to do something similar. We're going to go through and debunk a bunch of the the misinformation, but we're also going to kind of go, how does it, I mean, is this just an excess of compassion? Mm-hmm. You know, is that all it is? We're just too compassionate. But if that were the case, then why can't we get people in shelter?
Right.
You know, and if it is the case, how do you know when you're being too compassionate? You know, these are important questions. But I think to answer your question, I just think the way that we're going to, I think, get more moderation and more thoughtfulness and less extremism is if we have to do all three of those things. Debunk the myths, explain what actually works in the real world, and also try to understand what's behind the misinformation and extremism.
Yeah, I think that's really, really well said, Michael. This has been such an excellent conversation. So thank you so much for joining the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode.
As always, please share this podcast with your friends. And if you didn't get a chance, we would just appreciate you scrolling down to the bottom of that podcast page, rating us 5-star on Apple Podcasts so you can help other people find the show. We just so greatly appreciate it.
And we'll see you next week.